government. How would you any impressions about Nixon and the cabinet meetings?
Nixon was a very sharp guy, very astute. I never heard the four-letter words that he put on tape, that were on tape. He behaved himself, well, as you'd expect a president to behave. So I didn't see the aspect of it. And Watergate, to me, never became as magical a subject. A guy that I got to know pretty well in the Pentagon was a general counsel for the Pentagon, became Nixon's lawyer during the Watergate, and probably advised Nixon that nobody will ever get those tapes. Well, he turned out to be wrong. The judge said he's got to get those tapes. And that guy was a sharp lawyer, and obviously Nixon must have known he was a damn good lawyer. He became Nixon's personal lawyer on the Watergate matters. Nice guy. But it goes to show you how difficult it is to predict what's going to happen. No president has had to give up, I don't know how many, whether LBJ had tapes or JFK had tapes, I don't know that. But that's what did him in. Mm-hmm. And that's still being uncovered, what the hell he said on tapes. I don't know. He struck me as a knowledgeable guy. I didn't have that much one-to-one relationship with Nixon. I had more with Ford. For instance, with Ford, we tried to open up Elk. I think it was called Elk Hills in California. It was an oil. There were oil reserves that had been preserved since World War I. And we said, what the hell are we doing preserving it? Why the hell don't we open it up? And I had a chance to sit with Ford on that job. And he didn't. Normally, when you sit with a president, he has about a half a dozen aides, specialists. He didn't have any, and he was a very knowledgeable guy. But, you know, the press pictures him as a bumbling guy who stumbles over everything. Keep forgetting that I think he was third or fourth in his class in law school. But the image is still there of a stumbling guy who hits a golf ball into it. But he was a sharp guy, and he was willing to make decisions and do it without a hell of a lot of staff. So I met maybe a half a dozen times with Ford under those circumstances. And by the way, he finally agreed that we ought to open up Elk Hills, but God, that was a tough process. Why was it tough? Because there was only one oil company that was near Elk Hills. I think it was the whatever became the successor of Standard Oil of California. So the Congress worried about, God, there's only one company that can take this oil out of there, and only one company that had an oil line. And God, that they struggled with that for years. But finally opened it up. As a matter of fact, I noticed it was in the press probably in the last couple of months about increasing production there. But again, it's interesting the things that government does that make no sense whatsoever, which is to preserve that base. Even though there were people waiting in lines in 1974, not really waiting in lines because there was plenty of oil, but because of government action. And they wouldn't spend the money to improve Elk Hills because there were only a few people that could do it. They wanted to put it up for bids. Well, there aren't that many companies in Southern California. But it's tough. Those are the aspects of political life that's tough. You got to throw things open. The reason the Defense Department or the government has such old equipment in the FAA, you got to put it up for bid, and you got to pick the lowest bidder. And the outfit that has the best equipment doesn't get a chance. Matter of fact, I noticed on this John Glenn expedition that they said, God, that craft up there has about 10 laptop computers that were just bought off the shelf. And they were. But that's considered bad in the government. Because you can buy stuff for a tenth the cost. When I looked at the specifications for a thing like a simple radio, the radio would cost a bundle. And we tried 25 years ago to get the military services to buy stuff off the shelf. It probably took 15 or 20 years for that idea to percolate through, and probably it only percolated through when they were getting truly cut back, really cut back. But it's just too bad, because that's where the toilet seats cost $600. You look at the specs for a toilet seat, kid, there weren't too many people that would make those toilet seats. Well, I got to tell you one other story. When I was with DuPont, we sold probably the Army or the Air Force explosive bolts. And we sold them at, I don't know, 50 times what we sold explosive bolts to anybody else. And I asked my guys, I said, why do we charge the military so much for the explosive bolts? They said they want to destructively test 90% of the bolts to be sure they work. Well, when I first flew the F-14 or the F-15, one of the things I had to do was I had to get trained. Decompression chamber. I also had to learn how to eject my seat through the and there were explosive bolts there. And I found out right then and there. Now I know why you want those. Because, God, if they didn't work, you could be sitting with that damn seat, the explosive bolts. Destroy the seat, you pull a little lever to the seat would disappear. So there's method in the madness there someplace.
When you made the decision to leave, and you've already mentioned briefly how you had been talking to your association with Landau, but did you first call DuPont to see if you could come back to DuPont before you hooked up with Ralph Landau?
I got to tell you a little story about that. You can't do that. First, I had to show up in DuPont, and I rented a house up there, and then I went to see Irv Shapiro, who was then the CEO, and said, I'm back. Have you got a job open for me? Well, it's just like coming back from Japan. DuPont doesn't have a job open for me. They start thinking about it. But in about a week, he said, yeah, we have got a job. We've got a guy retiring as head of the international department. How would you like that? I said, that would be terrific. And I had about 2 months before this guy would retire. So I said, and in the meantime, Ralph Landau is coming in with this offer. Then, as I recall the story, the guy that wanted to retire wanted to get the announcement out that he was going to retire in something like 3 or 4 days. And this is while I'm negotiating with Ralph and telling him I'm going back to DuPont. So I had to make a decision with nowhere near enough information on whether I should stay with DuPont or go with Ralph Landau. So I decided to go with Ralph Landau, and I didn't have any kind of a deal. Matter of fact, a guy that was negotiating my contract is a Princeton guy named Joe Batchelor. He's become a very famous guy in negotiating contracts for people. And when I joined Ralph, he told me, I don't know, within the first month, that he had told his lawyers, he said, if the proverbial truck knocks me off, here's what I've agreed. But I didn't know that. So I had to make a decision with nowhere near enough preparation that I wasn't going to go back to DuPont, and I was going to join Ralph Landau in New York.
And you went there as president of Halcon.
Yeah.
Now, what was the arrangement? Where was Ralph? I mean,
Ralph
Scientific Designs was his original company.
Well, I was chairman of Scientific Design, which was still an engineering company. And Halcon was basically the R&D company.
Okay.
And Ralph, I think, was chairman of Halcon. He didn't want to worry about it. Matter of fact, it was interesting. The guys in Scientific Design, the 600 or 700 people, designing plants, they worried that Ralph had abandoned them.
Right.
Because he didn't spend much time with scientific design. I learned a little bit about what happens in smaller companies. I think one of the first staff meetings we ever had, somebody had come up with a proposal to do something. I can't remember what the hell it was. And no decision was made in that meeting. And afterward, I went up to these guys. I said, well, how did you come out of that meeting? We're going to go ahead with the project. I said, but nobody approved that project. They said, but Ralph never said no, didn't say anything. That meant we can go ahead, which said a hell of a lot to me about how organizations get signals. And the signals are not necessarily valid and open and real. It taught me a whole lot about it. Well, you know, I've had an interesting experience because I worked for big companies and a big part of the government and then a small company. And they were different, all different. And you had to adapt. You had to learn to do things that you wouldn't ordinarily do. When I first joined Oxyrain here in Princeton, I had a staff meeting, and I looked at the sea of young faces. I said, what the hell is the average? There were 1,000 people in Oxyrain at the time. I said, what's the average age? 28.
Wow.
28 years old, 1,000 people. And I was then 60 years old or 61 or something like that. And in my stupid way, I said, where's our retirement list? Well, the next youngest guy was 48. And then... But, now, that's so different from DuPont and the military, where people can retire from 48 to 55 there. But you learn to adapt. You learn to adjust. You learn to... Well, you learn to learn. That's basically what you do.
Now, Oxyrain was a joint venture between Halcon and Atlantic Richfield.
Yeah, right.
Was that already in place when you joined, or were you
No, it was about 9 years old. As a matter of fact, it had grown to $1 billion in less than 9 years. It had a plant in Holland, had a plant in Spain, a joint venture with the Spanish oil company. Had a plant in Japan, and the directors there with Sumitomo, and the directors loved to play golf, so we used to have our directors meeting in Hawaii at the Wailea, Hilton Hotel at Wailea. And had two plants in Texas, one in Bayport, Texas, and one at Channelview, Texas. And when I joined Halcon SD, they were building a new plant at Channelview to make ethylene glycol that I first talked to Ralph about that DuPont was going to get. DuPont, by the way, I didn't know that story, couldn't buy the ethylene during the energy crisis. So Ralph turned to Atlantic Richfield and said, how would you like to build a $200 million ethylene glycol? They did. And incidentally, that, I don't know whether you know much about the Oxyrain, but that was an interesting structure because Ralph went to Atlantic Richfield. The guy that headed up Atlantic Richfield Chemicals was a guy named Bob Bent, who went to Penn maybe a year or two before Ralph. I think they knew each other a long time. And then Bob Anderson, who was the chairman of Atlantic Richfield, set up Arco Chemical at the time. Now, Arco Chemical, when Bob Bent got it, their biggest product was wax candles. They separated wax from some oil in Hamburg, Germany. And he was anxious to build a chemical company. So Ralph came to Bob Bent and said, I will give you my propylene oxide technology if you put up all the money for the plant, but give me a 50% ownership of that joint venture. And Bob Bent agreed to that. So that was one hell of a deal for Halcon, because Halcon got 50% of the earnings and Atlantic Richfield about 50%, but Atlantic Richfield put up all of the money. Now, when I joined Oxyrain, the plant at Channelview was getting built. Was a big propylene oxide styrene plant and an ethylene glycol plant. that. Oxyrain owned the banks $460 million, which Atlantic Richfield didn't put on their balance sheet because it wasn't necessary to have a joint venture that was 50% owned. Put that money on your balance sheet. And as a DuPont guy, I didn't know the inside of a bank for borrowing money because nylon profits were so heavy, and by antitrust regulations, we weren't allowed to buy any company. So I didn't know how to buy a company, nor did I know anything about borrowing money. And all of a sudden, I've got Chemical Bank, which was the leader of 20 banks, which had $460 million worth of debt. So I got to know banks faster than I expected. But that was a hell of a deal for Ralph. Hell of a deal. And it was done because Bob Benton was hungry and because Bob Anderson would let him do it and let him put up the money. But the first plant didn't cost very much.
Now, you've indicated some of the problems that you found. You had tech support that only came from the owners. Oxyrain didn't have its own tech support.
No, it didn't.
Did you change that?
Yeah. I changed a few things when I got to Oxyrain. One is we were managing our European business from Princeton. Princeton's guys love to travel to London and Holland and Spain. I said, what the hell are we doing this? So we agreed to set up a an office, actually it was set up in Eaton. And the guy we hired to do that job was a guy that I'd been interviewing from Exxon. It took me about a year to persuade this guy to leave Exxon and join us, a guy named Don Wood. And he went to England to build an office building and then set up basically DuPont Europe. And then we had a guy who used to be a plant manager at Bayport, Texas. We set up Oxyrain USA in Houston. And I said, look, you're responsible for the U.S. Well, in that result, he wouldn't tell us anything about what the hell he was doing. I said, wait a while. You're responsible, but one of the jobs you have is to inform the management on what the hell you're doing. And it was tough for him to understand that there is a division of responsibility. One is to do what the hell he thinks is right, but he also had a problem. He was obliged to report it. It took about 2 or 3 months to persuade this guy that he was obliged to keep us informed of what he was doing. But he finally, and it shows you that this guy had a fairly narrow focus. When he moved back to Houston, he'd been the plant manager there, he moved to his old neighborhood. Well, he found out that unless he got up at 5:30 in the morning, it was going to take him about an hour and a half to get out to Channelview plant because the traffic in, I don't know, 6 or 7 years had grown up in Houston so much that he couldn't go his old route. Which said to me, this guy has a very narrow focus. But he did a pretty good job there for DuPont USA. But we did that, and we finally set up our own R&D. We were the first R&D establishment in the Princeton Forestall Center. Princeton owned, a couple of thousand acres there. And they had a plan that they thought would take 20 years for that site to develop up. I think it got developed in 10 years, maybe less than 10 years. And we were one of the first ones to rent a building. And matter of fact, when I talked to Union Camp Guy the other night that were getting fired, getting laid off, we got agreement from the owners of Oxyrain to build a new research laboratory right behind Union Camp, which is right on Princeton Pike. We bought, 50 acres of ground, and we picked an architect to design the building in the early stages. But that's when the ethylene glycol plant didn't work. So the whole damn thing was canceled. But we had agreement to do our own R&D. Matter of fact, we had a bunch of guys that we had hired to do R&D for Oxyrain. Because the thing that was interesting, when you had the parents do it, there wasn't any coordination of the effort. And they did what they... Well, I'll give you one example. And I don't know whether I mentioned it in my talk to Stanford. But we had billions of pounds of capacity, but nobody was working on process improvements, even small ones, for those processes. And so when we got a bunch of guys, probably 10 or 15 or 20 guys, to say, what is the likelihood of saving money on process improvements, even though they're small? After a couple of months, they said, we think we could save $120 million. I said, God almighty, that's a big number. About 6 or 7 years ago, I went back to some of those same guys and said, what did you really save? No, it came close to $150 million. Because these are large plants. We made, I don't know, 2 billion pounds of tertiary butyl alcohol. If you improve that by, God, even 1%, you save a lot of money. But the partners wouldn't do that kind of work. They didn't have the people to do that. Atlantic Richfield was an interesting company because it was put together by merging Sinclair Oil with the old Atlantic Refining with a third company. God, I can't think of it. And God, those companies, they stayed just as if they were apart. Even after reform. So there was no cohesive effort, and not many oil companies do significant R&D. Matter of fact, it was only after I left Oxyrain that Atlantic Richfield built a large, you know, R&D facility in Newtown Square. They bought an old, and it's a nifty facility, and a lot of, got to tell you one other story. A lot of the guys that I joined in Oxyrain were refugees from big companies like DuPont and Monsanto. I said, why the hell are you here? Well, we just hated a big company. When Oxyrain went down the tube and Atlantic Richfield acquired them, those guys stayed with Atlantic Richfield, which was a big company. So it says if you like what the hell you're doing, then you're treated fairly well. So that taught me a hell of a lot about what people really think and what they do versus what they say.
Another thing you found there was what you called an economic tower of Babel.
Yeah, that was interesting. Well, I told you, we had 1,000 people with average age of 28, and we recruited them from everywhere. So a guy who came from Exxon or DuPont or Gulf, all of them had different ideas about what the hell factory cost was or mill cost. All had different names. We had different names for earnings. You think, God, that ought to be synonymous. So that's where we had to basically put together what the hell we wanted to have said and then have everybody adhere to it, because we were getting numbers that were, well, it was hard for me to understand as a DuPont guy, because DuPont had its own regs. And I learned pretty easily how soft accounting is. Accounting is very soft. To this day, it's very soft. What the hell is the earnings of a company? You read in the Wall Street Journal that company X, Y, and Z didn't earn as much. How come? You got a big six accounting firm looking over their shoulder. It's because the rules are different. What you can call things are different. One of the jobs I was given in DuPont was, our sales expense was higher than the other departments. So I was asked to look into that. Well, I looked into it, and I found out the idiosyncrasies there are of accounting. Textile Fibers, which had a large facility at Chestnut Run, decided to call the money they spent out there R&D, not sales expense. Elkem, which I was with, called their spending out at Chestnut Run selling expense. That was one of the biggest factors in the way these two... Theoretically, all these numbers were the same. They weren't the same. They were different. And that taught me a hell of a lot about you better dig into accounting.